Chapter 14. We travelled in stupefied silence, or at least I think it was silence. The bomb had set my ears to ringing, and I doubt I could have heard anything short of a foghorn. We were a dazed group, horror and disbelief mingling with a profound sense of relief that there had been no injuries to speak of, at least amongst our party. I thought of the crowds gathered on the pavement and wondered what had become of them. When we arrived back at the hotel, the onlookers had mercifully dispersed. A bitterly cold wind had whipped off of the river, and tiny splinters of ice once more danced in the nimbus of the street lamps. I shivered, and Maximilian wrapped his hand around my arm.
"You must pretend to like the cold, Liebchen," he told me. "Ice runs in our veins, you know."
I knew he was not speaking of only the weather. The fact that a bomb had been hurled mere inches from us had been upsetting, but the Alpenwalders were making every effort to behave normally. I suspected his little speech was as much for his own benefit as mine. His fingers trembled where they gripped my arm, and his expression was grim, but it seemed quite in keeping with his character to make a jest in order to lighten the mood. We hurried into the hotel, the Chancellor leading the way as the captain brought up the rear. Stoker had given his arm to the Baroness, and she leant upon it with a grateful look. The suite seemed a haven when we at last reached its security and bolted the doors behind us. I thought of medieval criminals who hurled themselves into churches to claim sanctuary, secure that they were safe within those walls. The chambermaid, not JJ, I noted with some relief, was just kindling a fire upon the hearth in the sitting room to augment the steam heat of the suite, and she scuttled out as we arrived, curtsying clumsily to each of us, even Stoker, as she hurried away. The captain locked the door and went to assure himself that the remaining rooms were secure, as the rest of us collapsed into chairs near the fire. The Baroness and I shared the sofa, sitting as comfortably as possible given the constraints of our corsets.
"Drinks,"
the Duke said succinctly. He did not ring for the maid to return, but went himself to a cabinet in the corner and fetched a tray of glasses and a bottle with a label I did not recognize. The liquid inside was clear as ice, and he poured a stiff measure for each of us.
"Drink it quickly," he instructed me. "In one go."
I tossed my head back and swallowed. It tasted of nothing, just a sensation of cold, and then a ripe, blooming heat took hold of my chest.
"Better?"
he asked. I nodded. He turned to the Baroness. Her complexion was ashen, and I wondered if she was about to faint.
"Drink, Baroness," he urged.
She took the glass he held out to her with an unsteady hand. She looked doubtfully at her glass, then took a deep, shuddering breath to steel herself before drinking. She gasped, and the colour finally returned to her cheeks. "I am sorry about your tiara," I told her, as the Duke moved on to offer restorative libations to the Chancellor and Stoker. The Baroness looked down at the badly damaged coronet still clutched in her gloved hands.
"It is nothing, a bagatelle," she said.
It was clearly a valuable piece, but she was right. Compared to the cost of human life, it was nothing. She looked at Stoker.
"Mr. Templeton Vane, I must thank you. If not for your swift action..."
She broke off, pressing her lips together to control her emotion. Stoker flushed, the tips of his ears reddening adorably.
"Do not speak of it,"
he said softly. "Well," I said, "we shall have to agree upon a story for the police. No doubt they will be here in short order to question us."
We cannot afford scrutiny from the Metropolitan Police, the Baroness said, her lips compressed. Miss Speedwell's masquerade, as effective as it is, will not stand up to lengthy questioning by the authorities.
The Chancellor's expression was grim, and Duke Maximilian sat slumped in an armchair in the corner, his face pale. He was clearly still shaken, and I was a little surprised at his lack of spirit. For all the courage he had displayed at the time, the experience seemed to have left him oddly cowed.
I do not think we need to worry about that, Stoker said slowly. In fact, the Metropolitan Police can easily be put off on the grounds that this was not an assassination attempt at all. What do you mean?
The Chancellor demanded. The Baroness bristled.
My good man, we were there. We saw the explosion. Someone tried to harm our princess with a bomb.
That is precisely the point, Baroness, Stoker explained patiently. They did no such thing. The bomb was a squib.
He looked around at our collective confusion and began to elaborate.
I spent a good deal of time near munitions in the Navy. The bomb hurled at us tonight was nothing but sound and fury. There was a mighty noise and a flash, but no destruction. If we had really been standing so near a proper explosive, there would have been injuries, deaths even. The bomb that went off under the Tsar of Russia's carriage blew his legs entirely off, and we have sustained nothing worse than a little soot and some ringing in the ears. Someone wanted to sow a little panic without doing real harm. This was nothing more than a vicious prank.
My God,
Maximilian said faintly. He dropped his head into his hands.
But who on earth would do such a thing?
The Chancellor asked.
People might have been trampled to death trying to get away. It is a monstrosity.
I furrowed my brow and thought a moment. Anarchists?
Anarchists do not play at murder,
Stoker reminded me soberly.
Their intention is to kill, always. No, this was something entirely different, designed to frighten, but nothing worse.
He turned his attention to the Chancellor.
What will you say when the police come calling?
The Duke gave a start, dropping his hands.
The police? The English police? We are not subjects of your crown.
His bearing, always proud, took on a new hauteur.
No,
Stoker agreed.
But you are guests in our country, and your princess is a head of state. This event occurred under the noses of the Metropolitan Police. I recognized one of their inspectors at the opera. Surely you do not believe they will simply let this go and not investigate?
The Duke flushed angrily.
It is an outrage to suggest we cannot protect our own.
The Chancellor waved his hands.
Be calm, Your Grace. Naturally, the English police will have questions, but we will simply give them a statement saying we believe it to be a silly prank and tell them the princess does not wish to pursue the matter. They will have no choice but to leave it there. And, regardless of who was responsible, the fact remains that they did not succeed. We must move forward. And, as Mr. Templeton Vane says, we must proceed with our objectives as if nothing untoward has happened.
I do not believe I said anything of the sort,
Stoker began, but the Chancellor carried on as if he had not spoken, turning to me.
Fräulein, you performed very well, although I am certain the Baroness will have notes for you.
That august lady drew herself up stiffly.
Naturally, all performances may be improved upon, but I think the Fräulein has had enough for one day.
Stoker stared from one to the other in frank astonishment.
For one day? This was the arrangement, Your Excellency. Miss Speedwell impersonated your princess for the gala, and it is finished. We will naturally be returning to our own lodgings now.
The Alpenwalders exchanged glances, and by some unspoken agreement, it was the Baroness who appealed to him. She came towards him, her expression pleading.
Mr. Templeton Vane, you are right. We have asked a tremendous thing of you and your friend, and she has been a triumph. But our princess is still missing, and what we must accomplish here is not at an end.
He opened his mouth to speak, but she put her hand on his arm.
Please, I beseech you, not for myself, but for my princess. Stay here tonight. The princess may return by tomorrow morning, and then we will send you on your way with gratitude, such fervent gratitude.
And if she has not?
Stoker asked.
That is a bridge yet to be crossed, she said.
He looked to me, but we both realized it was a formality. Stoker could never refuse a woman in distress of any variety. To have the Baroness, a noble and handsome woman, pleading with him for so small a favour was far beyond his ability to rebuff.
Baroness,
he began, his tone doubtful. She must have known she had won as soon as he failed to reject the proposal outright, but she pressed anyway.
Our suite is very comfortable, she urged, and it is late, and you both have had a terrible shock. The explosive might have been a nasty prank, but it was still a dreadful experience, and we feel responsible. We have prevailed upon you both so far beyond the bounds of good manners, I shudder to think what opinion you must hold of us. To host you here, in luxury, with the most comfortable beds and the most delicious food, to send you home well rested and well fed, it is the least we can do. But perhaps you do not want to allow us the chance to repay your kindness and to make amends for what you have already endured?
Stoker looked helplessly at me. He always was far too malleable where women were concerned. I gave the Baroness my most gracious smile.
You are very kind, Baroness, but I think we should sleep better in our own beds. As you say, it has been a most exhausting day. We will, of course, be at your disposal should you wish us to call again, I told her. She inclined her head.
Very well. Come, Fräulein, I will help you change into your own clothes.
The Chancellor turned to Stoker.
Thank you for your efforts tonight, sir. You may change in the room you used earlier.
Stoker allowed the Chancellor to lead him to the room put aside for his use, while the Baroness took me to the Princess's bedchamber, careful to lock the door once we were inside. The business with the bomb seemed to have unnerved her even more than I had first realized. The Chancellor may be quite right, and you may wake up tomorrow to find her here, wandering like the three bears who has been sleeping in her bed, I added, with a nod towards the vast silken four-poster.
Just so,
she replied, but the frown did not leave her brow, and she moved mechanically through the lengthy process of disrobing and dismantling the royal creation she had made of me. Jewels were replaced in their boxes, hair pieces were combed out, garments were folded away. After some delay, Yelena appeared carrying a tray with a small teapot and earning a scolding from the countess for her tardiness. She gave the noblewoman a sullen look as she carried the gown off for sponging, banging the door behind her.
That girl,
the baroness fretted as she lifted the lid on the teapot, releasing a cloud of fragrant steam.
She has been harboring thoughts above her station ever since she took up with Captain Durand.
I understand they mean to marry, I ventured. The baroness gave me a knowing look as she poured a thin stream of liquid from the pot into a fragile china cup marked with the Alpenwalder otters.
In our country, we would say you have long ears, like a hare, Fräulein. The better to hear gossip. But yes, Yelena is little better than a peasant, you understand. For her to marry a man of the captain's station is a very great thing for her. It gives her ideas.
What is wrong with ideas? I asked gently.
La, you English women are all the same.
She clucked as she handed me the cup.
So modern with your bicycling machines and pamphlets on voting. Some woman shouted at me on the pavement the other day because she wanted money to stop vivisection. I told her, I do not even know what this is. But whatever it may be, ladies should not be shouting on pavements to stop it.
Vivisection is the performing of operations on live animals for research, I told her as I peered into the cup. The liquid was green in colour, and bits of dried petals floated on the surface. She pulled a face.
That does not sound very nice. Perhaps I should give her a few coins if I see her again.
She nodded towards the cup.
This is a tea, made of St. Otild's wort, she explained. We drink it in the mountains for all things, to ease us when we are wakeful, to soothe us when we are sad. It is even good for women's troubles, she confided. I thought it might calm your nerves after that dreadful incident at the opera, and perhaps give you a little energy as well.
I sipped it and felt myself beginning to relax at once. As a cream for the skin, it had smelt of roses, but the aroma of the tea was similar to our own elderflower, subtle and elusive. It was a gentle concoction, and I thanked her.
There's no need to drink it if you do not like the flavor, she told me. It is an acquired taste to some.
I do like it, I assured her.
Do you require anything else? Biscuits? Honey?
She asked, but I could see the signs of worry and fatigue stamped upon her features. Nothing at all. I am quite revived, Baroness, I said. My eyes fell then to the chocolate box containing the threat against Gisela. I took a few more sips of the tea. On second thought, a chocolate might be nice, I ventured. The Baroness looked at me in surprise.
Of course, Fräulein.
She pressed the box upon me.
You must take it.
I could not possibly, I protested. It is the Princess's. The Baroness shook her head firmly.
I insist. You have done a tremendous service for us this night. It is the least of what my princess would want you to have. You must take it,
or you will offer a grave insult." Her expression was mulish, and I knew we had already caused them unease by refusing to accept their hospitality for the night. Besides, it was easier to take the whole box than to steal the threat. "That is very kind of you." She helped me into my own things, which Yelena had sponged and pressed in spite of their being perfectly clean, then put out her hand. I regarded it with some astonishment. "You do not shake hands in the Alpenwald," I said.
"But you are an English woman, and I must thank you the English way," she said.
I shook her hand gravely, and she inclined her head, a gesture of profound respect from this proud aristocrat. I felt a quickening of some emotion, regret, perhaps, that my time with her had been so short. She was interesting in spite of her hedgehog prickles, and I should have enjoyed getting to know her better, not least because she might have been able to shed some light on Alice Baker Green's death or Gisela's disappearance. It had been my experience that people often knew far more than they realized, and sometimes extensive conversation was required to winkle the information out of them. She walked me to the door of the suite, where Stoker stood ready, divested of his moustaches, gold earrings glinting from his ears. More handshakes all around, and the Chancellor favoured me with a formal kiss to the hand. They were subdued, as a group, no doubt because of the attack on their princess and the fact that her whereabouts were still unknown. Duke Maximilian was still dreadfully pale as he bowed and kissed my hand, all trace of the flirtatious seducer quite absent as he pressed my hand.
"Gute Nacht, Fräulein. I hope our paths will cross again."
He gave me a tiny smile at the sight of the gold box in my hands.
"I see you have a souvenir of your time with us."
"I do. Would you care for a rose cream before I go? A violet cream, perhaps?" Stoker lifted the box out of my hands.
"I am certain the Duke's tastes do not run to English sweets," he said blandly.
The Duke's smile turned wintry.
"As you say, I have the continental inclinations. I will wish you both farewell."
He stepped sharply back, and we took our leave of the Alpenwalders. It had been an evening none of us would soon forget.